plate, the right-handed hitting catcher. 1-1 the count, misses high for ball number two. And Garrett, he has been phenomenal at just working on base. Mentioned it his last time up. He got hit by a pitch then back in the eighth inning. Led off the inning with the hit by pitch. 2-1 count coming home. It's a late swing and a foul back. Now a 2-2 count. Rafters once again down to their last strike. Garrett will try and keep them alive. On first base, it's Jake Beauchesne. On second, it's Royce Clayton Jr. 2-2 the count with two away in the top of the ninth. It's a three-run Mallards lead. Pitch on the way home, and Garrett holds off, but it's called on the outside edge. Strike number three, and a nasty breaking ball caught him looking for the final out of the game. The Rafters in the ninth inning, no runs, no hits, no errors, and two left on base. And the final score, 6-3, the Mallards win it. Well, not the way that the Rafters wanted today to go. They were hoping for some revenge. Instead, they fall to the Mallards. And on the season, a 3-9 record against Madison this year. Their final game against the Mallards. And the Mallards will try and go the rest of the way. A tough schedule for them, but they've got some work to do trying to make a playoff push. And quickly getting an update on that Wausau game. It's the bottom of the seventh. The Woodchucks have just two innings to get three runs. They trail 5-2, and this battle could be getting even closer after tonight, after the Mallards take the win, and the Woodchucks potentially could drop a game against the Rockers. But that is all projection. We'll have to wait to see the results on that. But the Rafters postgame show comes up next, and with it, we'll take a look back at how this game occurred and what all happened in it. And along with that, we'll take a look at the stats and take a look ahead to the next game up for the Rafters. All that comes up next. This is the Rafters postgame show on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
There's a quote about the importance of setting goals. If you don't know where you're going, any path will take you there. This holds true for things that are important to you financially as well. To set your financial goals, think about your priorities. Outline them as either must-haves, such as a comfortable retirement, or wish list, perhaps a vacation or entertainment. You'll want your goals to be specific. Assign estimate dates and cost to each one so you can plan how much to save and how much time you'll have before you need the money. Next, hold yourself accountable to stay on track. This involves actively tracking your progress, maintaining your focus, and using these time-tested strategies. Diversify, own quality investments, and keep a realistic perspective. A financial advisor can help with this. Finally, enjoy that sense of accomplishment when you reach your goals, seeing your efforts literally pay off.
This content was provided by Edward Jones for use by Clay Kanoki, your Wisconsin Rapids Edward Jones financial advisor at 715-421-0958.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns, it's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down. Discover your path to better mental health at HazeldenBettyFord.org/Wisconsin. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
Let's get back to Rafters Baseball here on WFHR Wisconsin Rapids.
And now time for the Rafters postgame show here on WFHR. The Rafters not able to get the win against the Madison Mallards. Final score 6-3. Let's take a look back at how it all happened, and one where the Rafters pitching yet again looked pretty good up until the end of the game, and the Mallards pitching really just stood out against the Rafters today. They allowed just the three runs. The Rafters, though, allowed just six. Four of them came through in the sixth inning, however. Taking a look back at it, first two innings, it was a great start from Eamon Mulhern. He went seven up, six down. He did issue two walks, but got one of them with a double play. On the other side, it was also seven up, six down. Two singles allowed by Jace Barajas, but one of them was retired on a caught stealing. So into the third inning, it was tied 0-0, and in the top of the third, the Rafters score three runs in the game. Hiroto Kobayashi scored on Kareem Arusevic's RBI single. Then Royce Clayton Jr. scored on a great base running play between Arusevic and Clayton. And when Kareem Arusevic stole second, Clayton was able to come home and score on the stolen base attempt. And then Kareem Arusevic came home to score yet again on more great base running as Madden Akko singled, and then he intentionally drew the throw down to second base, being caught between first and second, which allowed Arusevic to come home and score. And then eventually Akko was even safe at second. So great base running from the Rafters there. That put them up 3-0. And from there, the Rafters would not score again. Bottom of the third, though, one run does come across against Jace Barajas, his first run allowed of the game. It was on an error that Will Johannes came home to score. It was a double for him, and then he reached third on the single from Frankie Carney, and then a single from... on that single, he eventually ended up coming home to score on the error from Royce Clayton Jr., didn't pick up the ball correctly, and that left it behind in center field, which allowed both runners to advance an extra base. So that made it a 3-1 game. Frankie Carney tried to make it 3-2, attempting a straight steal of home once he ended up on third, but he was out at the plate, not the best stolen base attempt. Although he did make it close, he was not quite in time, so that ended the third inning. Fourth inning comes around, and the Rafters cannot score. They go three up, three down, although they do have the Eric Harper leadoff single. Lachlan Maude had a double play. Bottom of the fourth, it was another scoreless inning. Jace Barajas, though, he had to come out of the game after a hit by pitch, and then he threw two balls to Will Johannes. The second one, a wild pitch that got away, and that one, a pitch that took him out of the game. It didn't look like he was feeling good after that one, and hopefully he is all right. We'll have to get an update on him after the game, and hopefully he'll be able to return for the Rafters. But Justin Battle took over from that point on, walked the two batters he saw, and with the bases loaded, was able to get a ground out to finally get out of the inning. Fifth inning comes around, and the Rafters yet again aren't able to score. They have runners on first and second, thanks to a double from Clayton, and then a walk from Jake Beauchesne, but they cannot send any of them home. Bottom of the fifth inning, the second run of the game for the Mallards comes across. It was a walk from Cole Kosciuszko and then a MJ Sweeney RBI sacrifice fly that scored Kosciuszko to make it 3-2. Sixth inning comes around, and the Rafters, they have a walk, a strikeout, and then they have a couple of fielder's choices to get out of the inning. So once again, they cannot score any of the runners from first and second. And in the bottom of the sixth, that was the inning for the Mallards. They scored four runs in the inning as Jack Wiesinger just not able to get through the inning. A really tough one for them as there were RBIs from Cole Kosciuszko, Davis Hamilton, and Liam Moreno, along with Noah Sheffield. Noah Sheffield stayed hot today. Man, he loves hitting against the Rafters. He's always really, really good against Wisconsin Rapids. And then, after that sixth inning, things really just stayed the same. It was a 6-3 ball game for the Mallards. Obviously, that was what the score ended up as. In the seventh inning, the Rafters went down 1-2-3 in order. And then in the bottom of the seventh, it was the same deal for the Mallards as Tony Torres came in. Three up, three down in the seventh on just eight pitches. And in the eighth inning, the Rafters have a hit-by-pitch and then a walk to put runners on first and second with just one out. But then Lachlan Maude struck out and Luke Skinner grounded out to finish off the eighth inning. Bottom of the eighth, and the Rafters yet again get a 1-2-3 inning from Tony Torres, this inning on 10 pitches. He just threw 18 pitches through two innings and did not allow a base runner. He had two strikeouts as well, a great appearance from Tony Torres. But in the top of the ninth, the Rafters a walk and then another walk from Jake Beauchesne. But with two outs, that wasn't enough as Harrison Garrett struck out looking on a pitch on the outside edge. And that did it to finish the game. So the final score was 6-3. Let's take a look back at the stats and numbers from tonight's game. On the offensive side, no multi-hit games. However, Eric Harper reached three times. He went 1-for-2 with two walks. Along with that, Jake Beauchesne walked twice, and Royce Clayton Jr. went 1-for-3 with two walks. So a couple of good games there offensively, and the Rafters hoping that they'll see some better offensive performances tomorrow and Friday against the Lakeshore Chinooks. Taking a look at the pitching staff, though, Jace Barajas, 3 2/3 innings. He allowed just one run. It was earned on 5 hits, 2 walks, and 2 strikeouts. Not quite as dominant as his last appearance, and he had to be pulled early due to the arm injury, it appears, but we'll have to wait and see the status on that. Justin Battle went an inning and a third, and he allowed one run. It was earned on 1 hit, 2 walks, no strikeouts for him. And Tony Torres, 2 perfect innings with 2 strikeouts to finish off the game for the Rafters. But that just about closes up this game. So with that, let's take a look ahead to tomorrow's game, where the Rafters will take on the Lakeshore Chinooks back home in Wisconsin Rapids at Witter Field. Tristan Krusenberry on the mound for the Rafters. He's looked pretty good as of late, and, well, his last start, not the way that he wanted his start to go. However, he's been pretty good prior to that point, and hoping to get back to more of what he had been able to do when he gets back to work against the Chinooks tomorrow at 6:35 p.m. So that's when first pitch is, and the pregame show will start at 6:20 here on WFHR. Looking forward to that, or, of course, seeing you at the ballpark. But that is all we've got for the postgame show tonight. Big shout-out has to go to everyone in Madison for always making this such a great trip here. Always great people and a great setup that I've got. And a big thank you, of course, to Ian Paparocki, as always, for helping get me set up and provides a lot of information and help to make sure that my broadcast goes smoothly. Another big shout-out to WFHR for hosting us, as always, and Chuck Gennaro, our chief engineer, in case of any technical difficulties. And along with that, to the coaching staff for always being open to talk and speak about really anything that I need to have questions asked. One more final shout-out has to go to Madden Akko, our pregame guest, for joining us on the pregame interview today. Glad to have him joining us, and, well, hopefully there's nothing that took him out of the game outside of a coach's decision, but we'll have to wait and see there, as he, of course, did get pinch hit for back in the sixth inning. So waiting and seeing, and a couple of things that we'll catch you up on tomorrow, but that is going to do it for tonight's broadcast. So one final time here from Warner Park in Madison, Wisconsin, the final score, the Rafters 3-6. From myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, thank you and have a great rest of your night.
Their education policy was destroy the Department of Education and privatize student loans. So, and obviously, move towards privatization of education as a whole. But this case, the school district, Lawrence County School Systems there in Tennessee, their officials are moving towards a policy that will teach students work ethic and reliability by not allowing them to miss any days of school. They said that, you know, as adults, they're going to be expected to show up to work. If they get hurt, if they get sick, show up to work. Going to work? After 3 days of absenteeism, you will then have intervention. After 8 days, they're going to refer you to the court system. And you got to wonder, you know, is this the Trump effect as we're going after schools, dismantling the Department of Education, shaking down universities? I don't know. Here to share some thoughts on that and whatever we can jump in with the education policy. I've asked Ken Mash to come talk with us. He's the president of APSCUF. They represent Pennsylvania's higher education professionals. Ken, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Rick.
So what do you think of this policy? You know, we've got to teach kids work ethic, Ken. Got to get them some work ethic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's caught up with this idea that business is, you know, the answer to everything, as if business itself does such a great job. You have to start off with the basic principle that, you know, when it comes to public goods, right, there isn't a profit motive. And the profit motive should not be what drives things. And, you know, we just see that increasingly happening both in the private schools. We saw it with prisons. We see it with private schools. We're even seeing it with some universities, too, as, you know, private textbook companies are trying to do more and more with AI and get more of an inroads into public universities.
So, you know, in looking at this, and this is where I go, I'm watching what Trump is doing with Columbia first and now Harvard and other elite universities. I view it as a shakedown, but again, you've got a president who's, you know, hole into interventionalism, so much for freedom. What do you think of what's going on at those universities? Or are you one of the people who thinks, you know, maybe they earned this, maybe they deserve it?
No, I don't think that they've earned it. Look, I'm not going to defend every action that Harvard or any of the other universities took, particularly during the times of the protests. But, you know, we shouldn't pretend. And, you know, the reason that they're giving for doing this thing is, you know, protecting against anti-Semitism. But when you look at what they've been asking for, it doesn't have to do with anti-Semitism. It has to do, you know, in the case of the University of Pennsylvania, had to do with transgender athletes. When you look at the letter that was originally sent to Harvard, it was about, you know, them determining whether or not Harvard had an appropriate political balance among their faculty. It was about instructing them what they should and shouldn't teach. There was a long list of horribles that were included. So this is, you know, this is about an enemies list and the Trump administration going after those people that they consider to be a threat. And also, when we stop and look at it, you ask, you know, when it comes to actual democracies, you know, what do they have in common? And it is universities where there's free and open thought. And so it makes perfect sense that the Trump administration would be going after these institutions, particularly the elite ones.
So does it trickle down to you, or are you guys just small potatoes? They want to go after the quote unquote elites. Does this affect you guys?
Well, you know, it affects us in various ways, because when they go after, you know, NSF, when they go after, which is the National Science Foundation, or NIH, the National Institute for Health, and the research dollars that they provide, while we don't do things on the same scale as some of the research institutions do, we still, at our public regionals, are doing research, on top of which, you know, those people who are educated, who go to teach at our universities, got their doctorates and got to understand their fields at these universities. So when they start attacking these institutions, they are really attacking all of higher education.
No, you know, the concept of an injury to one being an injury to all, because you're all in the same fish tank or the shark tank. It's all going to come down to you. And ultimately, you know, aren't universities and colleges supposed to be the place where we have academic freedom, where we don't have a fascist leader saying you have to learn this and I'm going to punish you if you talk about this? It seems, you know, that slippery slope argument my friends on the right love to throw around seems like a little bit of that.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, for them, they look at the faculty and they may say, and, you know, they make all the arguments that the faculty has a liberal bent, which may or may not be true. But, you know, they somehow translate that into the fact that there's brainwashing going on at these institutions. And if there really truly was brainwashing or an attempt to brainwash, at the very least, we could all agree that universities have not done a good job. If that's what their goal is, to turn people into liberals and the rest, we wouldn't have Trump if that was the case, right? Look, we need universities because we need academic freedom. A lot of people don't particularly like that term, but we do need the ability of faculty to pursue research freely without interference from government. We need for professors to talk about difficult subjects.
Yeah, I mean, academic autonomy would be a much, much better phrase, I think.
Yeah. Probably. That's good. We need people to put the ideas out there. Some of the best students I have had in my career, I did not agree with at all. But it was through the course of conversation that they got to hone, you know, even if they were all the way on the right and I was much more liberal, in the course of conversation and in going back and forth, they got to hone their own ideas, right? Because they're in college, and what passes for argument in a bar or passes for argument in, you know, among family members doesn't hold water when you get to college. So if you want to maintain your ideas, even if you're conservative, you have to be able to be in a position to defend those ideas and to defend them in a way that is logical, that is backed with evidence, which, you know, I guess that matters less and less evidence nowadays.
Well, but, you know, for me, it's, you know, I'll go back to what I started off this segment with the story from Tennessee. There are a lot of people who think an education is just about getting a job and what you can bring to an employer. It's not about what you just talked about, defending your own ideas or honing your own opinions or being a well-rounded person. It has nothing to do with that. It's all about the job. It's all about, you know, very transactional. And, you know, these are your skills. This is what it's worth and that kind of stuff. Do you see that? I mean, or am I putting too much of that?
No, I think we've been dealing that in higher education in particular over the last couple of decades, where there's been this attack on higher education just in terms of, you know, are you getting a job and what's the cost of it? And you can, by the way, make the argument still that college education is worth it if you want to talk about it in those terms. But, you know, a college education gives you so much more than just simply a job. It gives you a way of viewing the world. It gives you the ability to understand the world that is going on around you, to appreciate where we are in history and what has preceded us. All of those things are important for making solid decisions. And, you know, and it teaches you, and even if we want to talk about jobs, right, the thing that makes the American higher education system, or did make it in the past, the envy of the world, was the fact that we were able to get across critical, you know, important, you know, fundamental ideas that are good for work and the rest. But on top of that you have critical thinking that goes on, and you teach people how to think critically. And you can't teach people to think critically if, you know, a curriculum is being imposed on you, right? Because that means you're not even thinking about what the curriculum is or what is getting across. So, you know, we lose out. We lose out in so many different ways. You know, Scott Galloway, I don't know if you know who that is. He's a professor at NYU and he has some podcasts. But he makes a very simple argument. If you look at what the Trump administration has done as far as barring foreign students from coming into the United States, right, not wanting them to learn at our universities, making it so much harder, that as far as a value proposition goes, like that, we were making out so well. Like people, other countries were sending us their best.
Yep.
and they were staying here, right, and contributing in technology and science and so many other fields, and we're going to lose that.
Yeah, and taking back our values with them and spreading the idea, the seeds, the kernels of democracy around the world. You know, no, this isn't new. This is something that I've talked about for years. And you're right. I think he's destroying that.
Yeah. It's so, you know, I would say that it's penny smart and pound foolish, but I'm not even sure it's penny smart. It just strikes of, you know, grievance politics, retribution, and all things that do not really pertain to what are we trying to achieve here.
Well, the grievance part of it, and I'm glad you brought that up, is because, you know, I know a lot of people who have a hatred of, you know, especially when you're talking about Columbia and Harvard and the Ivy League schools. There's almost a hatred of those universities. Because, look, I know some pretty snotty Harvard grads. If you've ever run across one, you know they're gonna be more than happy to tell you how much better than they are than you. But that's trickled down to a lot of folks that I know. So there's this general hatred now that seems to be percolating of people with higher education, and I think Trump has been one of the people who's kind of pushed that. So I look at this war on education that's going on, wanting to dismantle the Department of Education. That's going to harm low-income, poor, and working-class kids who are going to be able to go to schools across Pennsylvania and across the country because of dollars that flow out of that, Pell Grants, student loans, things like that. So I guess the question I have for you, if Trump gets what he wants and we do dismantle all that and privatize student loans and do all that, what's that going to mean for working-class kids who might not get a shot to attend one of the PASHE schools that have been the gem of Pennsylvania? What happens?
Yeah, our universities, and it's true of our universities, and it's true of universities around the country, particularly talking about public regional universities, are the engines of the working class. That is, moving people from the lower working class into the middle class. And if you start robbing that and you take away that opportunity, you know, there's really no route for you to take. And it's true, you know, there'll be some positions in tech schools where you can make some money, good money, and certainly we don't disparage people from doing that. But, you know, if everybody's going to go there, first of all, you flood markets and then there's no need for the people. But then on top of that, too, even with those jobs, what people, what they don't tell you is, you know, it, unless they're union jobs, you're going to be in that position. And, you know, say you're making $70,000 coming or $80,000 coming right out of the tech school. That's going to be your salary. Like, you may get some adjustments for, you know, inflation. But generally speaking, that's the end of it. Like, you're doing the job and that's the cost of the job. Right. Whereas, you know, sometimes those who graduate from college may start with less, but over time they earn more and more and more, and it keeps on growing. So, you know, it's really going to take, it's going to hurt our economy, because we're not going to have people who are going to be buying things, who can afford to buy things. It's going to hurt the communities where universities are located, often very rural communities, often in very red, in red parts of the states. You know, it's just going to hurt the people that unfortunately seem to support the president the most or have supported him in the past. They are the ones who are going to get hurt the most over the long term. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff, you know, you're not going to see tomorrow. You may not see next year. It's going to be wearing down over the next 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. And, you know, when it's too late, people are going to, you know, shake their fists and be angry. But the real thing is, who's putting us in a position where we're not going to succeed in the future?
Absolutely. And I would argue that by limiting these investments and destroying the Department of Education and cutting off Pell Grants and student loan opportunities and all of that stuff, and I think you're going to make inequality in this country that much worse. And that just benefits one group of people, the same folks who made out well in that one big, beautiful nightmare bill.
Yeah. You know, but let me give you some good news. I see some real activity going on, you know, not just in my union, but with the American Federation of Teachers, of whom we're an affiliate, but working with also the AAUP and then other unions, too, coming together and talking about how do we push back against this? How do we reshape the narrative that is going on? And for me, that's exciting, because it does come down, ultimately, all of this comes down to the people, because we're in an outside position when it comes to Washington. There's nobody, you know, fighting, or you can't depend on Congress, you can't depend on the courts, you can't depend certainly on the presidency. It means that it comes down to the people and what they're going to withstand. And I'm encouraged by the fact that people are standing up and they are fighting back, and they, you know, they're working on different ways of getting messages across.
Well, no, and that's great to hear, because, you know, what I said on election night, and my audience is probably tired of hearing it, I said, you know, look, it's going to be a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, but the solutions to our problems are going to come out of the pain caused by their savagery, and they are being every bit of savage that I imagine they would be. I still think there's a lot of worse coming, but to hear that there's that organizing happening, that coming together and going, hey, this is where we need to be going. That's exciting stuff. And I think it gives hope.
Yeah, it does give hope. And it goes to, you know, in this country, we've reached a point with union density that's pretty low. But unions really do provide that opportunity for people to get together, right? Outside of government, to combine. That's what unions are about, right? They're about power through collective action. And the fact that the unions have been the ones standing up, and that is totally true, that it is the unions who have been pushing back, have been fighting in the courts, have been leading demonstrations. You know, I think people should take that not just as, oh, good, few people are fighting back, but with, how do I get involved with a union, right? How do I get a union job?
Right there.
Because that's the real answer. because when you don't have governmental power, right, you need outside power, ways of coming together.
I was going to ask you a last question. What should people do? You just said it, join a union. Seems very, very simple. Seems like something we should be, I don't know, maybe working towards. But Ken, as always, I appreciate the time, the great information. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure, Rick.
Our good friend Ken Mash is the president of APSCUF, the Association of Pennsylvania State and College Faculty, University Faculties. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Maybe an isolated evening storm, partly cloudy tonight, a little hazy from smoke and lows in the mid-50s. And it still could be a touch hazy with sun tomorrow. Nice day, though. Highs in the mid-70s. And it stays nice on Friday. More sun and upper 70s. It's 67 right now.
There's danger out there. It lurks on highways and quiet neighborhood streets. It's more likely to kill you than a shark, and more terrifying than the biggest snake. Distracted driving claims lives every day. Every notification, swipe, social post, video, or selfie while driving risks your life. So while you might think public speaking or the zombie apocalypse is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward. Don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, on Monday, I did something that I haven't done in a while. You know, since my wife's accident, I really haven't done those things that I used to do all the time. But on Monday, I gave myself the day. I got someone to come sit with Carol and just bailed. So the crew went and decided, let's go kayaking. So we headed over to the Delaware River, and the place where we launched from is a federal park. So the people who work there are federal employees, and it's owned by the federal government and all of that. When we drove in, something caught my eye. Now, again, federal run park, that big sign, card only. They don't take federal dollars. No cash. No cash allowed at the federal park. And it made me go, you know, I'm amazed at how easily this whole card-only thing has taken hold. And it's, this whole crypto thing now scares me even more. I'm here to share some thoughts on, well, the Genius Act, the crypto, the move towards digital currency, and maybe I'm just a curmudgeon. I don't know. That's why I've asked Alexandra Thornton to come share some thoughts with us. She's a financial regulations guru over there at the Center for American Progress. My go-to person to kind of help me work through some of this. Alexandra, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here's my concern. Look, it's amazing to me how fast this card-only thing is taking hold. Can't go to a sporting event, a concert. Can't go anywhere without going, sorry, cash not accepted here. I fear eventually we get to the point where, you know, crypto only, baby. That's it. That's frightening to me.
Yeah, I think that there's an important distinction that we should make here to start out with, and that is, you know, we have everything in our financial system now digital. It's much of the financial system is digitally recorded. Banks record the money in your account in a digital ledger. Many people use a spreadsheet at home to keep track of their own assets instead of holding paper stock certificates, for example, in a physical folder. But that's very, very different. And I want to emphasize this. That's very, very different from crypto assets that we're going to be talking about today, because those are actually, whether it's a stable coin, a Bitcoin or other crypto asset, those crypto assets themselves are digital, but the real trick about them is that you can trade them, you can transfer them from one person to another with no intermediary like a bank. And that has important ramifications, which I'm sure we'll discuss today.
So walk me through, what is this Genius Act? What is this? And you know, how does the Genius Act ensure that these digital currencies, like the stable coin that you referenced, that it's not going to lead right to a corporate control? Again, my big fear as a labor guy, we go right back to company script, the old company town model. What's in that that's going to stop anything like that?
Not too much, actually. So the legislation actually purports to regulate a specific kind of crypto asset, not all assets, not bitcoins, for example. It's a regulatory regime for stable coins. And stable coins are a particular type of crypto asset where the issuer claims is worth exactly one U.S. dollar. So one stable coin, one U.S. dollar. 98% of stable coins worldwide are pegged to the U.S. dollar. You can peg them to other currencies, but most are pegged to the U.S. dollar. So this legislation purports to sort of set up a framework of regulation around stable coins and the use of stable coins. But actually, it has a lot of gaps. There are many places in the legislation where Congress people couldn't come to an agreement on how to handle it. You know, some members raise concerns about financial stability and the treatment of consumers and all of that, and illicit financing of elections and so forth. And so they couldn't resolve them all, and they left it to the Treasury to close those gaps, to come up with rules. And there are about, I don't know, 10, maybe 10 different places in the bill that call for the Treasury Department to promulgate rules. And so those have not been done yet. And so there are a lot of open issues about how these are regulated. And I would caution your listeners to be very wary of using stable coins if they haven't before, and even if they do, because this is not like a green light. This is not safe like your deposits in a bank.
Because one of my concerns is you know, I know there's been some information coming out of the Trump administration allowing pension funds to get into crypto, allowing mortgages to be written with using crypto as assets. And you know, the fluctuation for me is kind of frightening. It appears to me that we're setting up another 2008, and you know, something that Alan Greenspan said at the time, or why they couldn't regulate, you know, what the securities that they were doing, is because it was such a complex financial instrument. And then his response was, we didn't know people would commit fraud. This seems to me, and again, as an outsider, not a financial person, this seems to me to be another one of those really complex things that maybe you shouldn't be playing with.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right to be concerned about that. This is a weak regulatory structure that's being set up for stablecoins. There is no regulatory oversight structure for any other kind of crypto asset. So basically, this weak structure is a similar kind of thing to what happened in the 2008 financial crisis. In 2000, there was something called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and that was supposed to provide a regulatory regime for over-the-counter market trading of complex financial products called derivatives. And none of that matters except to the point that, like we have with crypto assets today, they decided to kind of create a special regime, actually an almost non-existent regime, for swaps, which was a particular kind of derivative. And as anybody who's read anything about the financial crisis knows, swaps became multi-trillion dollar market. People started, you know, engaging in swaps derivatives. And ultimately, it was swaps that contributed to the 2008 financial crisis. Right. The lack of transparency, the lack of oversight, resulted in an inefficient market where the end users were prevented from making informed investment decisions, even while the dealers in swaps were reaping huge profits.
And again, I come back to, you know, right now, crypto is overwhelmingly held by a handful, a very small percentage of the population. And right. What I do know is every time there's one of these newfangled things, one of these situations where we're setting up the next bubble to go burst, I know it's working people who end up taking it on the chin, and I'd like to try not to have that happen.
Yeah, that's smart, because there are a lot of risks for consumers here. As I said, you know, consumers will take money out of their bank accounts potentially to buy stable coins, and that money is insured in a bank. It's backed up by the FDIC up to like $250,000 per account. But when they buy stable coins, there is no such insurance. And if those stable coins are lost for any reason, they're just gone. Poof. That's it.
So my fear then, Alexandra, of this being the next bubble that we're going to end up bailing out, is that something that I should, that is warranted or unwarranted given what you just said? Because there's part of me that goes, every time rich people get themselves into trouble, it's the poor and the working class that come racing to their aid. Not the other way around, but or at least my view. Curious.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right to be concerned about that, because essentially what you're going to have is, you know how when people get worried about a bank not being in a stable condition, there are runs on the funds in the bank? Well, the same thing can happen with stable coins, only worse. And because the stablecoin issuer is actually, they're supposed to buy assets to back up the stablecoin so that they can redeem them if the person who owns the stablecoins wants to redeem them for cash. So they invest in these treasury bonds or whatever they invest in, and they may hold them in a bank. So the banks and the stablecoin issuers are connected. So you have that much more risk with these lightly regulated stablecoin issuers and runs on stablecoins causing contagion in the market. And as we all know, that often ends up with taxpayers bailing them out.
Oh, but before I move on to the conspiracy theory stuff, your expert opinion, good, bad, was this the right move? Because my first thought was, you know, Democrats should not have voted for this. I get why Republicans did, but Democrats shouldn't have. You're just giving another reason to hate you when things go bad. So any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that, you know, the fact that not many people are actually involved in crypto is a really important point here. In 2024, less than 8% of the population actually engaged in crypto in any way. So it's not clear that many people care much about crypto. And I think that the crypto industry saw an opening to take action, and they'll, of course, benefit from this in a way that's similar to the budget reconciliation bill, for example, where we saw in that bill, and I'm sure you talked to your listeners about that, where, you know, that had a lot of benefits for wealthy people in terms of the size of the tax breaks and so forth. Meanwhile, in that same bill, those tax cuts were partially paid for by cuts to Medicaid and SNAP. And so it's a similar kind of thing with crypto. The crypto industry will win big from this, but it's not clear that the average consumer will.
Because my problem is this is opening the door. Maybe it's not bad yet. Maybe this isn't going to trickle down yet to right. We, the working class. But I know it never stops. The ball keeps rolling. And I have some Red Hat friends, some of my MAGA friends, who over the last couple of years I've been very concerned about China's social credit score and how Democrats were going to bring that here. And I kept going, no, we wouldn't tolerate such a thing. But I'm watching how quickly we've moved to, you know, doing our own checking out at the grocery store, now going to concerts or whatever, and only using a credit card and not digging in your pocket and using cash. It seems, I don't know, it just seems the seamless transition away from dollars and cents into a digital currency that sadly I look to the history that we're going to go back to the future of company towns, and Elon Musk's already got a company town having his own crypto, or much ado of nothing.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there's going to be a proliferation of these stable coins, and it will be, you know, actually consumers, as I said, they aren't using this much, and they are very wary of crypto at this point in time. And as long as they understand that this legislation doesn't really improve the situation in terms of the safety of crypto, I think they will be very wary, and perhaps they won't buy into the whole stablecoin thing. Why would you want to buy something with a stablecoin when you can just use cash or even your credit card and you don't have to pay transaction fees, at least for the stablecoin?
For now.
Right? I'm sorry?
For now.
Right. Exactly. It could change. Although this legislation does say that stable coins can't provide interest. Now, you get interest on the money you have in a bank account. So why would you want to hold your money in the form of stable coins? You know, and your stable coin wallet won't be insured. And another really important thing for your listeners to remember is that if you get a bunch of stable coins from one company, you probably won't be able to use those stable coins with another company. You'll have to pay a fee to transfer them, convert them back in, or redeem them for cash. And then you can use it to buy another stable coin or buy something else. So it's not as easy as it sounds. There are companies trying to change that by offering more universal stable coins. But at some point, it starts to look like the dollar, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, at the end of it, my concern is we've already got that instrument. It's called the dollar. Why are we recreating something else that's in the hands of most people who would own them? Probably can't tell you who controls whatever coin they've got or whatever digital asset or where it comes from or how it comes from. And that again, I go back to the concern being we just returned to a company town where you work for a company. They control all of your assets, all of your spending. And the other thing is, you know, with all of this stuff, you know, top to bottom, you know, the concern for me is always, you know, I went to the park the other day. Now somebody knows that, you know, so much for freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another thing to remember is that, you know, all these companies, when they issue stable coins, they're going to have access to your bank account information. And so that is going to be another, you know, more proliferation of companies that have access to consumers' personal financial data. And that's along the lines of what you're talking about. It's definitely a concern.
Yeah. No, I mean, so because it's been pitched to me and it helped me here because I admittedly, I don't know as much as I want to. I don't get it. But it seems to me that this is a way that potentially you could centralize, you know, the entire global banking system. Or is that just a step too far conspiratorially?
Well, I think the crypto industry does have a vision of having all credit cards and payments and everything being done in crypto. But as we've talked about, there are a number of really big problems. There's also, in addition to financial stability, there are national security problems. You know, we have this great infrastructure that's already set up that protects people's cash when they put it in banks and so forth and when they pay for things in cash. And that financial structure is not being replicated fully with crypto. And people should just be really aware of that. And so it's hard to imagine that this will become a universally used thing. But
I sure
we'll
hope not. But, you know, again, if you would have asked me before the pandemic if I wouldn't be able to spend my dollar, the money I have in my pocket, if I wouldn't be able to spend that in about half of the places I go to, I would have said, no, in this country, we'd have never tolerated that.
Right.
But I went to a federal park where they don't take federal dollars.
Yeah.
They only take Mr. Visa or Mr. American Express or Google Pay or something on my phone, not their dollars. And that's, you know, maybe I'm just a little getting old, but I didn't think this would happen this quickly.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that the industry is really pushing it through because they stand to benefit greatly from it. And so we'll have to see how far it gets. But I think that in the meantime, your listeners should be super wary and careful about this.
100% agree. Alexandra, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Always great seeing you. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Alexandra Thornton, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer of Federal Regulations over there at the Center for American Progress. You can check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you on the crypto bandwagon? You think it's going to be the future? Or are you just, have you gotten used to using the phone to pay for everything? I want to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day that U.S. President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed Medicare into law. This federally funded health care program provides assistance to one of the country's most vulnerable populations, the elderly. At the time the law was enacted, many seniors found it difficult, if not impossible, to get private health insurance. President Johnson signed the law in a ceremony in Independence, Missouri, the hometown of former President Harry Truman. While in office in the 1940s, Truman had proposed a national health insurance plan. Unfortunately, he was unable to get his plan through Congress. President Johnson wanted to recognize Truman's efforts. At the bill signing ceremony, President Truman received the very first symbolic Medicare card. The law went into full effect in 1966. 19 million people registered for the benefit. One of the labor leaders who fought for Medicare was Nelson Hale Cruikshank. Nelson held several positions for the AFL-CIO, and he spent his career advocating for social insurance protections for working people. He earned the nickname the Father of Medicare. The same year that the Medicare law was passed, Cruikshank explained why he thought it was so important to reform health insurance. He said, quote, "In too many doctors' offices today, the Hippocratic Oath has given way to the Dow Jones average." By 2010, 48 million Americans received their health insurance through the Medicare program. 8 million were people with disabilities. The rest were seniors. The program has had a tremendous impact on the quality of life of millions of older Americans. Yet, since its inception, there have been those who aim to make it less accessible by scaling back benefits and raising the eligibility age.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So before I get a flood of emails coming in to educate me on crypto and digital currency, I know there's a difference. But again, you know, for me, my concern is that at some point they become one and the same. It is amazing to me how quickly we've accepted the things that have been forced upon us by corporate America. The self-checkout thing to me is just amazing. People just flock to it. In fact, the other day we were at the supermarket. There were people waiting in line to check themselves out while the cashier was standing there looking at her phone because nobody was coming through. They've already trained you to do it. And, you know, it's I go to sporting events or to concerts and you hear people complaining, they only take credit card. And most people are probably going to pay with their credit card anyway. But the fact that that choice has been taken from you, that quote unquote, that freedom has been taken from you. And it's not going to stop there. It's only going to get worse. And as I look at the digital currencies, reminds me of the move to ATMs. Everyone got an ATM card because, oh, you know, you could use the automated banker. You don't have to go inside. And they laid off a bunch of bank tellers and kind of moved you in that direction where I don't want to wait in line. I just want to get $20 out or whatever. And it was free. In fact, at the beginning, they paid you. It was like a quarter every time you used it. They got you, hey, this is pretty easy. I like that. And you got a quarter out of the deal. Then that quarter went away rather quickly. And then, well, now they charge you to get your money. And I see this as the same way. Whoever's going to control the system is going to control the transactions. And that's when then the conspiratorial stuff comes in. What do they do with all the information that they're gathering from your purchase of Cheetos or whatever? You know, is it going to come to a point to where, you know, we looked at your grocery bill and, you know, you had a lot of red meat, so that heart attack you had, we're not going to cover. Or, you know, your diabetes is getting out of hand. It's because, you know, you bought those ding-dongs or whatever. Is that coming? When they decide that they no longer want to issue dollars and coins, because I guess we're doing away with the penny now, and nobody seemed to put up a stink about that. How far does it go? And yeah, while I understand there's a difference between them, my concern is that we end up with one currency, you know, like the dollar. And Alexandra was right. We've got a system, works pretty well, pretty secure. Why you would want to get into crypto? You want to invest? You want to gamble? If you're one of those folks who wants to gamble, I guess, good luck. Because everything that seems to go up, you know, it finds its way back down. My concern is that when the bubble bursts, and they do, these bubbles, they go pop. My concern is that it's the working poor who are going to end up paying the consequences. because these crypto companies, they don't have any assets. There's nothing there. There's no one backing. There's no backing, as I understand. It goes belly up. There's nothing to go get. If you buy a stock, you invest in a company, at least when the company goes belly up, you sell off the company's assets, you divvy up what's left. There's something there. But this, nothing. Poof, gone. So for me, my concern, we end up with another one of these really complex financial tools that ends up jabbing the worker in the back. You know, you remember 2008 was not fun for most working people across this country. But good news on the horizon. And thank you to Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, Sean, my Teamster president, Sean O'Brien's favorite Republican, or one of them. But he's introduced a piece of legislation that's going to give free money, tariff checks, $600 for every adult, every child. You know, everyone's getting it, kind of like the stimulus that we got during the pandemic, but a little tariff welfare. And it's interesting because, you know, they were running around saying that tariffs aren't going to raise the price of things, and now realizing that the reality is yeah, kind of going to. Now, look, I've said from all along, I'm not an anti-tariff person. I think Trump's going to booger this up, and he is. I do think prices are going to go up because of just how broad-based they are and because they're preparing us for it. And look, as long as we're using a digital currency, we're not going to have to dig in our pocket and actually count out money. It's just going to come out. But this $600, this could be the answer. This could make that one big, beautiful nightmare pill a little bit easier to swallow. And finally today, for my tinfoil hat crowd, you got that tinfoil hat under the red hat, you know who you are. Republicans right now, they're moving to push some legislation to stop weather modification. Yep, no more chemtrails, no more causing hurricanes, no more whipping up a tornado, no more of that stuff. No more space. I'm sorry. I had someone the other day tell me that the reason that it's raining so much is because government wants us on edge. They want to make us unhappy. This is the theory. They want to make us unhappy at President Trump for misusing the rainmaker, because, you know, his economy is doing so well, and that all of his promises and all of his pledges are coming true, and the country's back again, and the liberals want to, I guess. You go from there, figure out the rest, because it's ridiculous. But anyway, they're going to move on some legislation that should really, you know, make the conspiracy theories online, you know, skyrocket. But they've introduced and they are passing and enacting some laws to ban weather modification and environmental geoengineering. No more chemtrails. No more lasers, no more any of that stuff. It means that just God is going to be angry with us, which is weird, because if we really were that Christian nation that we're told, as much as it's been raining and as angry as some of the storms have been, if that were true, that God were angry every time a storm happened, he's ticked. Or she, however you want to look at that. Somebody really unhappy. So there you go. No more chemtrails. No more whipping up the storms. Our government in action. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You will most certainly find ours. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Leave comments, all of that. Like, subscribe, share, do all that stuff. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick at Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio.
WFHR 1320 AM, W248DE Wisconsin Rapids.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Trump signs an executive order imposing major tariffs against Brazil. CBS's Linda Kenyon.
The president has followed through with his threat to impose 50% tariffs against Brazil. Trump's executive order cites Brazil's policies and the criminal prosecution of former President Bolsonaro, calling them an economic emergency. Previously, Trump said tariffs were meant to address trade imbalances, although the U.S. has a substantial trade surplus with Brazil. The president has said Bolsonaro, whom he considers a personal friend, is being treated unfairly. Bolsonaro is on trial for attempting to overturn the results of his failed election. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
The president also announces a 25% tariff on India and other penalties for buying Russian oil. The Transportation Safety Board holds hearings into January's deadly crash near Reagan National Airport that left